At first, I thought it was a gross tactical error for Dub to announce that I would be filling Gene Brigette's shoes, but then I noticed that the vast majority of you have never heard me speak, so we're good to go. It is an honor and a privilege to be in the company of so many good speakers, faithful brethren, gospel preachers, but it is also a great honor and a privilege to be involved in a very good work, and I commend heartily the elders for continuing this great work that is being done. It is a wonderful lectureship. I know a great deal goes into it. I will echo the sentiments that were stated earlier about how organized things are here. Many of you that are involved in this lectureship know how difficult lectureships are, and it is fascinating. Of course, I knew ahead of time this would be a very organized and articulated lectureship, because going up the road here, coming up Church Parkway, I noticed a curve at 33 miles per hour and another one at 26. And the frightening thing was there was a Selma police officer sitting on the corner down here, and I did my best to get that 26 on that one corner. But I knew when I got here, things would be precise, and I appreciate that. I do appreciate being here. In fact, it's a little intimidating, frankly. There was quite a bit of trepidation going into this. Dub called and made the comment that he needed someone to fill in, as Gene would not be here. And by the way, I highly commend you to the book. I've seen the rough copy, I suppose, of his lecture, his manuscript, and it is excellent. And if you do not want the intense pain of finding out that one of Dub's books is out of print, you better get in there and sign up for it, because I have felt that pang in my heart not being able to get a hold of some of his books. But I commend to you his lecture, his manuscript. It is very good. But when Dub called up, I realized that he was in a panic. But he did say that this lecture suited me very well because it's on difficult passages. And I'm a difficult person, so it fit real well. Apparently he'd been talking to my wife. But I thought as we began our lecture, the very first thing we ought to do is try to define what difficult is when we talk about passages in the Scriptures. What constitutes a difficult passage? And so I want you to look, for instance, at 2 Peter 3:16 and recognize the fact that Peter, in speaking of Paul's writings, would say that some of Paul's writings were hard to understand. Not any surprise, then, that we might look at his companion Luke and understand the, I heard earlier about the connection that Luke and Paul had, how it was commented about. No big surprise to men who understood the rigors of academia, who would have common interests, who, after having served together, would have common experiences, have a lot to share with one another. It's not any surprise then that as we read Luke, we might find passages that perhaps would be hard to understand. An educated man writing to a common people might have those kinds of things occur. And Peter, you will note, does mention the fact that Paul wrote some things that are hard to understand. But I want to note a couple of things about that. This hard to understand passages. It says here that they are hard to understand. It doesn't say impossible to understand. My conviction is a lot of what has to do with hard passages has more to do with ourselves than the passage. It's our ability to open our minds to what God has revealed to us through His inspired writers that makes things sometimes difficult. And it has a lot, perhaps, to do with our predisposition. The shaded glasses we wear when we read things that perhaps Paul or Luke might write. I have good denominational friends who, in studying with me, have determined that 1 Peter 3:21 is a hard passage, mainly because they believe they are saved by grace alone. And all of a sudden you get to a scripture that says, baptism doth also now save us. Not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So again, that's a difficult passage for them, not because the passage is hard to understand, but because they have a preconceived notion due to the error they have been taught. Frankly, Martin Luther thought the whole book of James was a difficult passage. You know, it has to do a lot with how we view things as to whether or not something may be difficult or not. The second point I would make about hard and difficult passages and the fact that they do exist has to do with the nature of the Bible itself. Far be it from us to know the mind of God other than what He has revealed. And I'll grant you this, there will be things from the mind of God that He does reveal that will not be immediately picked up. The Bible is not meant to be a harlequin romance novel that we read in 5 minutes and understand it over our morning coffee in Danish as we do our morning Bible readings. And it's not that I would discourage you from reading in the morning and doing a regular Bible reading, but let me submit that that will not be a substitute for good, solid meditation and study in God's Word. You need to study it in depth, because this is not something in which you will read it in a surface manner and be able to attain the knowledge that God intends for us to understand. So be it known that when we talk about these hard passages, that what we're talking about are things that can be understood, I believe, with study. Now, I recognize, too, that there are some things that have not been revealed. Certainly, God has given us His mind in what He wants us to understand. And that is here, we can understand if we will give ourselves to the study of it. But there are some things we won't know, and we shouldn't dwell on those. I don't think particularly we should make great issues in the brotherhood over things that we haven't, things that are not revealed to us. We should study those things that are revealed and come to a like-mindedness, and then we can be unified. The second thing I would point out that has been submitted as hard, what creates a hard passage, has to do with conflicts with secular historical knowledge, or what is known, quote-unquote, I say tongue-in-cheek, by secular historians. I find it disturbing, particularly, in fact offensive, that when it comes to biblical knowledge, the record we have of what the Bible states, that it is always the document in question when there is any conflict. I resent that. As a matter of fact, I believe our stance has for too long been way too defensive. It's not that I would try to offend people intentionally, but I believe we need to go on the offensive with that sword of the Spirit, which is not predominantly a defensive weapon, but an offensive weapon. Too long we have sat back, stomping out little fires here and there, when someone cries out, oh, there is no such finding as the Hittite nation. And for the longest time, theologians backed and cowed and tried to make excuses, until finally some archaeologists dug up not just a little smattering of evidence, but evidence on a massive scale that showed us in Turkey there was not only a nation of Hittites, but a massive, powerful nation. And all of a sudden, we don't hear about it anymore. Why is that? I think it ought to be thrown in their face, not out of spite, not out of meanness, not to be vitriolic about it, but to point out that God's Word is always true, and we have nothing to apologize for. When it is stated in the book, we can stand for it. And so it is that when we look at things, well, for instance, the evolution thing. Why, if Darwin were alive today, he wouldn't recognize evolution as he formulated it. About the last vestigial organ they've got on the list is the nictitating membrane in your eye. And if you get something in your eye, it's not terribly vestigial. It's pretty necessary then. Where are all these vestigial organs as we kowtow and bow to the evolutionist and warp and twist and wrest the Scriptures to our own destruction in Genesis, the first chapter? Let's stand for what God speaks about and testifies to. And when we find, as we will in Luke, a text where he perhaps is the only one who records this historical event, let's count it as a historical evidence of fact, as opposed to apologizing for it and trying to make excuses for it, which, by the way, I will not do. You will also find, too, that sometimes passages are difficult because of a spiritual blindness in a person. It's a little bit different than predisposition, but it's a spiritual blindness of either willfulness or ignorance. And I would think that one of the best examples might be turned to in Luke, the 20th chapter, 3rd through the 7th verse, which is evidence to me that some people desire to be blind. It's no wonder that Jesus said in some cases we need to wash our hands of certain situations. Sow returns to her wallow, dog to its vomit. There are some times when you have to wash your hands because someone will not accept the truth. They are willfully blind. In Luke, the 20th chapter, you find Jesus posing a question to the Jewish individuals there whose hearts were rebellious. His question is not going to be answered, not because the answer is not self-evident. It's because people are not nearly as dumb as we think them, or not maybe a little smarter than we give them credit for. They see the consequences of the answer to the question, the correct answer to the question. And in seeing the answer and the consequences of it, they refuse the consequences, thereby having to make some kind of a rationalization for their answer. Jews here understood quite well that if we answer that John's, the immerser's baptism was from heaven, then we should have obeyed it. Hadn't we not, we've been in error. If John's baptism was not from heaven, all the people will, all of a sudden we won't be popular with the people. So we're caught in a dilemma, the horns of dilemma. And so we look at the consequence and we refuse to answer the question. A lot of passages are hard like that because people refuse to answer the question. Romans 12, 1 and 2 talks about the change we should make, the transformation that should occur in a Christian's life. And my friends, it cannot occur if we are willfully blind. If passages become difficult because we see a change necessary in our life that we're not willing to accept. Secondly, I think also when it comes to spiritual blindness, some people are ignorantly so. Those I have great sympathy for, however, it's not an excuse. Jesus in Luke 8:10 was asked, why do you speak in parables? And it's because he wanted those who had the heart to understand, and those who did not and did not research it and did not pursue it would not. They would look at its surface meaning, as so many do when they read the scriptures, not comprehending what is being said and what is being taught, and dismiss it as unimportant. My friends, ignorance and willful rebellion will meet their doom. In 2 Thessalonians 1:8, Christ will come in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those two classes of people who know not God and obey not the gospel. Those who are willfully ignorant, or those who are ignorant, those who are willfully rebellious. We don't want to fall into either of those categories, so as we begin discussing difficult passages, I want you to note that the resolution of these scriptural difficulties often has very little to do with the scriptures. And having said that, then, let's pursue some of the questions, some of the statements that are being made as difficult, and let's look and see if their solutions might show themselves. The first one we find in Luke chapter 1, verse 17. In Luke chapter 1, verse 17, the statement is made concerning this text. Reconcile the declaration by Gabriel that John would be in the spirit and power of Elijah, Luke 1, 17, with John's denial that he was Elijah, found in John 1, 21. I've kind of classified this one as those who have a hard time with the hard evidence. It never amazes me the propensity for people to be caught up in idolatry. It is amazing to me how difficult it is for some to serve a God who is intangible. We see evidences of that all throughout history. You can go all the way back to Gideon's ephod. You can go to the ark during Eli's time when Hophni and Phinehas felt sure that God's presence among them through this ark would give them a victory and lost the ark and was responsible for the death of Eli. You find throughout the Dark Ages with the popularity of relics amongst Roman Catholicism, the idea of having the presence of something that was holy, that was representative of God, physical, tangible in such a way that the relics became so popular at one time that I think it was Mark Twain that commented, there are enough shards or splinters of the cross of Christ to roof a barn in Europe right now. But apparently, we have this propensity to desire something physical and tangible in order to perceive or conceive of a God that we serve. And you know, the same thing plagues us today. People caught up in this notion that a kingdom is going to be established in some physical, material sense. Why, it's so popular that a series of books has come out, Left Behind, if you're familiar with those, that focus on the fiction of Jesus coming back to earth and somehow establishing a physical kingdom in physical Jerusalem, Christ coming to this physical earth, reigning on a physical throne therein. All of this, as you have noted, I've emphasized, is all physical. And people have never read that Jesus said in his trial, my kingdom is not of this world. And we just can't perceive of that. We can't understand that we serve a God that's immaterial. We serve in a kingdom that it is in both heaven and earth, existent today. We've been translated into it according to Colossians 1, 12 through 14. We are a part of a kingdom that already exists. And yet people still clamor for some physical kingdom, some physical manifestation of God on this earth. Should it be any surprise then that when John is asked the question in the Gospel of John, are you Elijah? What would his response be? I think this basically is a great lesson in context. So many have looked at the Bible and very often come up with notions about God's teachings that have taken Scripture completely out of its context, and disregarding the context has come up with doctrines that have no connection with God's will whatsoever. Who was John speaking to when he was asked this question in response? What is the nature of their question? That's the real issue here. And their question was, are you the literal Elijah? Are you the one coming back? In fact, we see that is the mindset of these people. Well, look at the Jews and their notion of kingdom. They have no less a problem with a physical kingdom than people still do today with the notion of a physical, material kingdom. Why, they were thrilled when the Christ came. They saw the trappings of the makings of a great king. Why, in the first place, he could feed an army. Notice what he did with the 5,000. You know, this guy could feed an army just out of thin air. Certainly he would be a great king. He goes into the city on the back of a donkey and he is lauded and applauded and honored as king. People's concept and notion at that time of a kingdom was one of a physical nature. They were finally and once for all going to be rid of that cruel human Roman bondage under which they suffered and chafed constantly. And so they were looking for a physical kingdom. Certainly John was the Elijah of prophecy. In Luke 3:4, we see the echoing of Isaiah 40:3, his crying in the wilderness, the announcement of angels in Luke 1:14-17 to his father, the notion that is brought out in prophecy, Malachi 4:5-6. You see that even Christ himself confirmed it, and what you get into trouble with in seeing this as a conflict is seeing Christ mistaken about who John was. Or you see John lying about who he really was, unless you understand the question. The question was coming from people who believed that there would be a literal kingdom, and prior to that, there would be a literal Elijah show up on the scene. You see, their mentality was so physical, they could not conceive of someone coming in the spirit of Elijah. Edersheim, in his voluminous tome, that means a huge fat book, has an addendum at the back in the which he points out that rabbinic tradition of that time literally expected Elijah's arrival when at length the time of Israel's redemption arrived. And little wonder, we even see the correlation with that and the question Jesus asked his disciples. Does it ever, you know, make you wonder what exactly the response meant when he asked, "Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" Some say Elijah. They were expecting someone of great massive power in a physical way to show up as basically in a struggling kind of way, a reincarnation, if you will, of a literal Elijah. And what they were expecting was a physical kingdom. And what they were expecting was freedom from Roman bondage. And in looking for all these things, Jesus was grossly misunderstood, as he is yet today. I appreciate this difficult passage because it has such relevance today in a society of people who in this day stand in these pulpits and these church buildings around this town and propagate a notion of fear and trepidation about the coming of the Lord and setting up some kingdom here on earth and being prepared for some thousand-year reign and some tribulation. Folks, the shock and the dismay of people like that, still looking as the Jews were for something physical, is going to be overwhelming when they discover their error and it's too late. You and I need to have people understand, those that are in our circle of influence. We need to have them understand that the kingdom has been established. It is not of this earth. This kingdom exists in the form of the church, something planned and prepared for by God since the beginning of time. And you and I can be a part of that and see Christ through eternity. The second statement that we will look at has to do with the passage in Luke 2:2. It's been touched on in other lectures. Explain the difficulties, or the difficulty involving Cyrenius in the King James, who was not appointed governor of Syria until around 12 to 15 years after the Lord's birth, Luke 2:2. Well, the first thing that we have to understand has to do with a bit about history, particularly the history of antiquities. Having history minor, I did considerable work in history, and I did enjoy it thoroughly, still do, have a good library in history. And one of the things you understand as a historian and studying history is that very often it is the case that one makes suppositions or assumptions about a culture, an ancient culture, oftentimes based on one witness, one testimony, one piece or parcel of evidence. And it is the case, and it's surprising to me, that it is the case that when this one piece of evidence or testimony or some witness of some sort surfaces, all kinds of fanfare is made about this particular bit of evidence, and all kinds of assumptions can run amok concerning that one piece of evidence with no one questioning the evidence per se. Yet you let one particular piece of evidence come from Bible, scriptural text, and all of a sudden it is suspect, and it's not worthy of mention unless there are some corroborating evidence out there in the world. And I'd submit to you that is the wrong way to look at things. We understand that Luke was a historian. Luke gave an accurate record, if his record is to be believed, at his very outset, of the things, the events that occurred during Christ's life. It is a reputable historical record. Now, granted, he does not give every small piece of historical occurrences or, you know, things that occurred during Christ's life. We understand that is the case, but that does not nevertheless take away anything from the fact that Luke was a historian. In fact, I have to concede it chafes me to no end when people begin questioning the Bible, and yet they will build all sorts of piles of theories about all kinds of other things based on the very slimmest of evidence, and that's all right to extrapolate that from those kinds of pieces of evidence. But let the Bible mention it, and all of a sudden it's taboo. Have a real problem with that. As a matter of fact, what really burns me worse is when those who are so-called Christian, quote-unquote, scholars, start kowtowing to this nonsense. William Barclay is one of them, and this it blows my mind when somebody this bright, this brilliant, this articulate makes a statement such as this. When he talks about Luke 2 and Quirinius being governor, he says, it might be that Luke has made one slight mistake. Now, I've got a question to answer Mr. Barclay here. If he made a mistake here, what's to say he has not made a mistake in various and sundry other parts of his document? As a matter of fact, who qualified him to say that Luke was mistaken to begin with? Is he privy to information we don't know about? All of a sudden, the arrogance of such a statement, the gross stupidity of such a statement, becomes very relevant to our discussion today. If Luke made a mistake here, why not just say, like another author did, and I think even in his arrogance, he finally goes ahead and goes to the logical end of this kind of statement. He made a little mistake. One author said, here you have no fact at all, but a clumsy invention, a careless antedating of what in fact happened some 12 years later. He's referring to Acts 5:37. It is, in fact, nothing better than a legend, such a legend as habitually grows up to decorate the birth stories of our favorite heroes in mankind. Well, at least he's honest in his gross ignorance of where this will lead you when you concede the fact that Luke perhaps has made a mistake. And I would expect that from heretics and apostates, and I would expect that from atheists and agnostics, but someone who claims to be a Christian, which he is not, someone who claims to be a Christian ought to know better than to compromise in an issue like this. There is no mistake here. If this is the only place we find any notion or any thought about Quirinius being governor at this time, there is no mistake. Mind you, he is a historical writer. It's verifiable. Luke said it. But secondly, I would note this too, and this is a strong point, in that he contradicts no data that we know of. And I think that's an important point. It would be one thing if it were the case that he flatly contradicted some document or some record elsewhere, but that's not the case. As a matter of fact, to be sure, Quirinius was governor later on, but that's not to say that Quirinius could not have been governor prior to that. As a matter of fact, we'll discuss the idea of that governorship anyway in just a moment and what it actually might have meant. But it's a fact that Luke does not contradict any historical data, and because of that, we should not automatically then assume that because the only historical record, the only evidence we have is that statement of Luke's, what makes Luke unqualified as a historian now? Because we have no corroborating evidence? Because there is no other evidence that will go with what he said? I don't think that this is a reason to dismiss what Luke said. You will note, too, that Luke was an educated man, an articulate man. He was one who, in several areas, very specifically pinpointed correct historical data. As a matter of fact, even Josephus confirms the fact, and by the way, you'll notice I did not say Luke confirms Josephus. It's the other way around. Josephus confirms the fact that in Acts 5:37 we did have a census taken. And what you will find here in a moment is that because individuals give, such as Luke, a piece of evidence, it is just as reliable, but more so because he is an inspired writer, as any other evidence that we can find. So if it is the case, this is the only place that it is mentioned, it is still worthy of historical note and credible. Being a precise writer, though, this might bring up one of the difficulties that people throw into this passage. Oh, Luke was so precise and so historical, and he hit the Acts 5:37 census right on the button, so apparently he just made a mistake over here. But my argument and contention would be, if it is the case that you will concede he was so accurate and so precise, why is he coming under question over here? Because there is no physical evidence outside the Bible of this particular census. I don't understand why all of a sudden now he's questionable when before he's very accurate and articulate and very much the historian. I think it's inconsistent. I think it's also dishonest. I think it shows a prioria, an opposition to Scripture by itself. In other words, if it comes from the Bible, it automatically goes under question unless we have something outside the Bible to defend it. And I think that's the wrong perspective to look from. If you will note several points of evidence, and one particular point I think is quite noteworthy, it runs pretty much in the same line or the same vein as the evidences of Christ's resurrection. The very basis of our Christianity. Frankly, folks, if Christ did not rise, our resurrection here, the hope of resurrection is vain, void. Our being here is fruitless and useless. If Christ did not rise, our Christianity, our faith is based on the fact that he did rise. And you will note that he rose from the dead, and we have a historical record in the Gospels, and that during that time there was all kinds of opportunity to discount the resurrection. And there was one putrid, poor attempt at it. Oh yeah, the guards were asleep when they came and got him. How did they know? Things like that are so simple to debunk. They had plenty, ample opportunity to disengage all kinds of things about the resurrection scene. They couldn't do it, and they didn't do it. And so we have in history the resurrection of Christ, the basis of our faith. Likewise, we have here an incident where Luke makes a statement in a gospel written early in the church's career, and nobody says, oops, Luke, you boobed here. You got to turn back and set this up right and fix this. You know, the very silence of that correction gives credibility to the fact that Luke knew what he was talking about, and probably early writers knew what he was talking about, and that's why they didn't correct him. You might think about that as a reason why this should not be a difficult passage. But certainly, as you continue on to things that we are now discovering, and by the way, these, I believe, are just incidentals that do nothing more than verify the truth that we already know and should have great confidence in as truth. When Luke said that Quirinius was governor in Syria at this particular time and there was a census taken, demanded by Augustus, that we ought to concede that is the fact. And here are some things that corroborate that. Here are some things, incidentals along the line, that we have found that do say that is the case, and we're discovering them as time goes on. One is a dig in Egypt that turned up massive amounts of papyrus documents. A considerable number of census papers were discovered amongst these documents, and they established that there was census activity on a 14-year cycle, and instituted by Augustus nonetheless. And on this 14-year cycle, you can go backwards from Acts 5:37, and that census that, yes, Josephus does confirm, was the fact that Luke said it was. And as you go backwards, you find that there would have been a census of sorts in around 8 BC, and that's when Herod was ruling, and that's when Christ in that neighborhood was born. And so we find that there is no problem with Quirinius being governor or being involved in a census at that time. Now, as far as his being governor there, if you look at the original terms that come that are translated in governor, as far as the term governor, a high office is often translated governor in English, but it's a generic term. As it turns out, it may refer to legatus, which is specifically the governor of the province, or a caestor, and I can't say those Latin words because they put the letters together. But anyway, it means an imperial commissioner. As a matter of fact, we know that Quirinius was in that area at that time, when Jesus was born. We know that there was a census being taken there at that time. And so when you have added to that, from 104 AD, a Roman official's letter book in the which he describes an Egyptian census and states, there is an ordering that all people are to go back to the country or county in which they live within the next 6 weeks in order to be ready for the census. It was a registration. Taxation is a bit of a, not a mistranslation, but you have to have it as a broader term. A registration so that Augustus would know who to tax. So lo and behold, when you look at all the details, this one does not provide for us a difficult passage either. Makes sense that Quirinius was in that neighborhood at that time, could very well have been governor or at least a commissioner there in charge of a census that Augustus did order in that 14-year cycle, and that lo and behold, Luke is definitely right. And there should never have been a doubt to begin with. The third text, or the third question that's on the list, is why did the Spirit lead Jesus into the circumstance in which he was tempted? This one was, even with Gene's tremendous manuscript, a very difficult question for me. Did considerable research. I'm still not satisfied with all of the answer that I would like to have, but hence the difficulty of the passage. But you will notice that if you look in James, the first chapter, 13th and 14th verse, one of the unique features of humanity is our capacity to be tempted. Jesus, as God, and sometimes we have struggles with that dual nature that exists between man and God. We think of Jesus as God, and rightly so. We think of him as the healer, the miracle worker, the individual whose connection with God the Father was so close that they were one. I and the Father are one. And we forget about the humanity. And I think we shortchange our perception of Christ when we do that by virtue of the fact that he understands what we struggle with. Christ is, and like we do many of our heroes, we do place them on a pedestal. I can understand fully why God hid Moses' body. Can you imagine what would have happened in a Middle Eastern culture had Moses' body been there for the Israelites to mourn over? We tend to place men on pedestals. Christ certainly deserves that pedestal, but let us not forget he was also man. He had common traits that man had. He had hunger like men have. He had pain like men have. He had frustration on several occasions where he would say, "How long am I going to be with you guys and you don't understand?" That's a loose Jeff paraphrase of Jesus' frustration on several occasions. And the point being is Jesus was also man, and we don't want to forget the fact that he was man. And so when we look at temptation, we understand that we are tempted when we are drawn away by our own lusts. My first response to this is to understand that God cannot be tempted with evil, and that neither tempteth he any man. So when you talk about in a statement or a question, why did the Spirit, God, lead Jesus, God, man, into the desert to be tempted? What you find there is a seeming conflict in the way the Bible teaches this. I would submit a couple of things. Number one, we have to understand Hebrews 4:15 and the fact that Jesus would be tempted as we are yet without sin. And that's one of the things that qualified him to be the high priest that he is to us. He can do more than just sympathize. He can empathize. He's been there. He knows. He understands our woes, our struggles, our trials, our hardships. In being able to do that, he could only have done that were he tempted. But I also would submit that Jesus in his flesh, even with the temptations that could have appeared, would not have been tempted like we would, because he would not have been led away by his own lusts. And so therefore had to have some divine help in order to set up this scenario whereby Jesus could undergo the struggles and the trials that you and I go through because we give in to the lusts of our flesh. Guyon Woods made a great distinction about that indicates a distinction between the origin and the agency of temptation. God certainly did not tempt Jesus. Satan did. The Spirit led him out there in order for trial and test to be had so that he could be qualified in order to be our high priest. And the last one, and I will just touch on it briefly as I see my time is up. In Luke 6 and 20, We have there the beginnings of what we find in Matthew 5 through 7, except that in Luke we find them scattered all over the place. And certainly the statement is, explain why there are numerous statements scattered throughout the book of Luke, all of which are found in the Sermon on the Mount. Number one, we have to understand, when these gospel writers wrote, it was not their intention that we have a completely chronological account of everything that went on in Jesus' life. As a matter of fact, in John 20, 30 through 31, we are told by the gospel writer John that there's a lot of things that happened we don't have in print. And so we have to understand that that is the case. Secondly, these four Gospels do not contradict. There is no synoptic problem. It is merely a case of teaching being done at different places in different ways, and certainly the repetition of some of the teaching that he may have done all in one setting, as Matthew records it. I don't see any problem with repeating some kind of teaching or doctrine. In fact, we have inspired examples in Paul, who said in Philippians 3:1, it doesn't bother me to remind you of things. And certainly in Galatians 1:8-9, in the very same text, he repeats a statement twice in two different forms for effect. So that Jesus taught the Sermon on the Mount. And then in Luke, we find him teaching in various and sundry different settings. These same principles shouldn't surprise us. Jesus often taught the same doctrine in different settings. Look at Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:3-9. Same doctrine, two different settings, in the same gospel. So why should it be surprising when another gospel writer points out these same doctrines in different settings? And certainly we have to understand that while we lack as preachers for nothing concerning the Old Jerusalem way, there will be times when we get up and we do preach repeats. Now that's not to say that we have forgotten our outlines or that our wife failed to put the outlines out, you know, early enough for us to preach them Sunday morning. You thought LaVon only did the bookkeeping. No, there's other things she does. But nevertheless, we find that God's will in his revelation does not change, and it does not adapt with culture. We should adapt culture to the book. And therefore, we will find many times a repetition of the faithful sayings of Christ. I think a lot of these difficult sayings are only difficult to those who are close-hearted. Honestly speaking, I realize that there are some things that are hard to understand, but they're not impossible to understand, and I recommend to you that the grass withereth and the flower fadeth, but the word of God will stand forever, and if you will study it, it will be there as you mature. Thank you for your attention.